Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I want to take this next bit of time to just tell you a little bit about what makes mathematicians excited about solving problems. So I will warn you, for all of you practically minded scientists, there is very little practicality in this talk. But hopefully there will be some things that are delightful in their own way. So just kind of a broad outline of what I'm going to be talking about today. I want to give you kind of an idea of what is being studied currently among mathematicians. So the pure side, the applied side, and kind of things in between. And then give you an idea of what motivates mathematicians to solve a problem and give you three particular examples of theorems and conjectures that have gained some fame in the mathematical world in one way or another. And then finally, since we are talking about the natural sciences, I want to ask whether mathematicians care about the physical world and what we think about when scientists use mathematics. So just kind of a broad overview of math. We generally split math into pure math and applied math. And pure mathematics, you can think about this as being the study of structure in general. So as mathematicians, we've kind of expanded from looking at numbers and looking at geometry to looking at kind of what is this underlying structure. And some of these subtopics include algebra, where we're really looking at the way that we combine different numbers. So you think of addition and multiplication, but then we want to abstract that some more. So we don't think about them as numbers anymore, we just call them some elements. You're combining some elements in some ways, and you want to see what happens with that structure there. You also have analysis, which returns to these numbers that we have worked with before, the real numbers or the complex numbers, once you introduce that square root of negative one as I, kind of analyzing what's going on with those particular numbers. You can also look at topology, which is sort of an extension of geometry, but all of a sudden, we don't really care if you start squishing the things. So a square somehow becomes the same as a circle, because I could take that circle and sort of squish in the squish it to make it square-shaped, or I could take a square and push in the corners to make it circular. So topology becomes sort of the study of space in this squishy geometry sort of way. You could also look at logic, looking at that foundation of what it is that makes axiomatic systems work well. And this just gives you a few examples of what pure mathematicians think about. We kind of start with the numbers and the geometry of sort of more classical mathematics, and then we try to abstract from that. On the other side, you have applied mathematics. And so these are any sort of applications that you can have with mathematics, but generally we're still looking at them from more of a structural view rather than the direct applications. So you can think of differential equations. These are used everywhere in physics and biology, so I'm told. And so you're looking at these relationships between changing quantities. And we can study that from a mathematical perspective and then apply it very directly. So that's kind of what throws it into the applied field. You have mathematical biology. You're modeling all of these different biological processes. All of the things that you saw during COVID about flatten the curve, that all falls into that mathematical biology, those graphs. They did actually mean something. You can also look at cryptography. So this is applying mathematics to secure communication. So trying to make sure that when you put your credit card information in the internet, it's not immediately stolen. And then my own sort of area of study is coding theory, which works with things like data compression and error correction. So when you put in your DVD for however many people still have DVDs, if there's a small scratch in it, you should still be able to watch the movie. because not every single little bit on the DVD is necessary. So there's some sort of ability to correct for some slight errors. Of course, if there's enough scratches, then it just doesn't work. So that's kind of a general idea of the different types of things that mathematicians study. But what motivates mathematicians in general is not so much the application or the usefulness, but it's more of a delight in beauty and elegance. And what do I mean for that from a mathematician's standpoint? There's this one equation that has been called the most beautiful equation. Some mathematicians and scientists voted on it, so it must be at least nominally true. But this is Euler's equation. So one of the things, or some of the things that make this kind of a beautiful equation to mathematicians is it contains five values, numbers if you will. I know sometimes some of these are not quite considered numbers. Some of them, I think Thomas Aquinas probably would not consider any of these to be numbers, but that's okay. We'll pretend that they're numbers for the time being. You have one and you have zero, which are the foundations of really the counting numbers, everything like that. And then you have pi and e, which are the two most famous transcendental numbers. So pi as that ratio between the circumference and the diameter of a circle. And then e just comes up in calculus. And it's kind of a strange thing to come up. This is Euler's constant, about 2.71 and some other decimals. But it ends up coming up a lot in logarithms, things like that. So you have those, and then you have that imaginary number I that I mentioned before. So you have each of these kind of five very fundamental numbers. They each come up exactly once in this equation. You also have the three most fundamental ways of combining numbers that come up each exactly once. So you have addition in there. You have the multiplication of I and pi. And you have exponentiation, e raised to the I pi. Right? And so these, you could think about subtraction, division, and logarithms. Those are all undoing these three sort of primary methods of combining numbers. And then finally, you have an equals sign. And that is the best part of this, because if that equals sign wasn't there, then this would just be garbage. But there is an equality there, and there is a way to sort of interpret all of this where e to the I pi, you're combining these transcendental numbers, this imaginary number, and somehow that's all negative 1. And negative 1 plus 1 is 0. And so you end up with this very concise equation that is also equal. So that's one thing that we kind of delight in, is this simplicity and, just conciseness of things. And this extends to proofs as well. So we have equations, but we can also look at proofs. Paul Erdős was a Hungarian mathematician, very prolific in the 20th century, so much so that mathematicians kind of number themselves according to how many degrees of separation they have from Erdős in publication. And he would talk about this mysterious book, the book, which would contain all of the most elegant proofs of all of the mathematical theorems. And one of his sort of life goals was to find proofs that would be in this sort of divine book. He said that God held the book, sort of in a very Platonist idea there. But I just want to give you an idea of what would make a proof elegant. So I have here a proof by picture, which could use some explanation, but you have probably all heard of the Pythagorean theorem at one point or another. A squared plus B squared equals C squared on a right triangle. And here, I'm going to use this guy to indicate, we have a square, an A by A square that has area A squared. We have a B square, right? B times B is B squared. It's the area of that square. And then I have a C square here. Right? And the theorem says that if I take the A square and the B square and I add them together, it should be the same area as the C square. This is what the Pythagorean theorem says. And here in the image, we have two squares that are A plus B by A plus B. So those two larger squares have the exact same area. And then each of those squares are made up of these four ABC right triangles and then this green region. So you see that because we've just rearranged these sort of triangles inside the larger square, those green areas must be the same. So this would be a very elegant proof of the Pythagorean theorem for mathematicians. So this is really what we're looking for. So I want to give you some examples now, these three examples of when things go a little bit awry and mathematicians are not quite as thrilled. So the first is the four-color theorem. And this question sounds like it might be practical, but it's not particularly. So the question is, how few colors can be used to color a map so that regions that share a border don't have the same color? Right? So it's very practical in whenever you're coloring maps. It turns out that cartographers don't actually care because they're looking more for something that looks nice, and they've decided that five colors tends to look nice. So they've completely ignored all that mathematicians have researched about this. However, we can look at, for example, in this map of the US, if we just look around Missouri, we could color that section just with three colors. Right? You can color Missouri yellow, and then going around Missouri, you can alternate these greens and blues, and that section can be colored with only three colors. However, if you go over to Nevada and you try to do the same thing, you color Nevada one color and you start alternating going around, you get into a problem when you hit Arizona because California's already been colored blue, Utah's already been colored green, so now we need a fourth color to color Arizona. So we need at least four colors. And the question would be, well, could you make a map that needs five colors? Could you kind of make another weird situation like this Nevada one? And Francis Guthrie in 1852 was looking at all this and he said, well, I can't make a map that needs five colors, so I'm pretty sure you would only ever need four. And so thus began the hunt of a proof for this conjecture. Several years later, in 1879 and 1880, there were a couple of proofs that were proposed, but then about 11 years after each of those were proposed, someone else came along and said, by the way, you forgot something. This is not a valid proof. It's sort of missing some sort of details there. Percy Heawood ended up taking one of those proofs and adjusting it slightly, and he said, well, this shows that you need at most five colors. So he had the five-color theorem, but people still wanted to show that you needed at most four colors. We still didn't have an example of needing five colors. So in 1976, over 100 years after this problem was first proposed, Kenneth Appel and Wolfgang Hocken, American and German mathematician, were able to prove the four-color theorem. But there's a problem. Their proof reduces the problem to 1,834 cases, and then they fed these to a computer. They said, computer, go and check these. And the computer said that it was all good and that the four colors sufficed. But mathematicians just despise this as a proof. Father Philip Neri was talking about the knowing that something's true and knowing why something's true. Mathematicians are just always on the why bandwagon. So we know that the four-color theorem is true, as long as we decide to believe that this computer checked everything correctly. Some people apparently went through all the code that it outputted and thought that it was good enough, so it's generally accepted. But this is not sufficient to figure out why this is true for mathematicians. So people have continued to look into this problem. We know that the theorem's true, but it's not a very elegant proof, so we want to try to find some other way. And other mathematicians since then have reduced the number of cases, but they're still sort of checking hundreds of cases through a computer. There's another one where sort of they don't reduce the cases, but there's a particular computer program that sort of checks proofs, and they rely on this program still. So that search for a nice proof of the four-color theorem is still out there. So if you have any ideas, feel free to, let me know or prove it yourself and have immediate mathematical fame It won't go very far, but it'll go at least among the math community. So that's one kind of example of things that really intrigue mathematicians, but you know, we kind of run into problems. So we really like the problems that are easy to state, but then we also really like elegant proofs. Another thing that we can look at is the Collatz conjecture. This one's still open, and especially if you're, you know, thinking about lots of other things right now, you can, if you'd like, choose a positive whole number. Any will do. I would pick one probably below 10 or 20, because if the number is even, you're going to divide it by 2. If it's odd, you're going to multiply it by 3 and add 1 to that. And then you'll take that new number and divide by 2 if it's even, or multiply by 3 and then add 1. And you just keep doing that, and you see whether or not you eventually get to the number 1. So if you started with 1, then you're in luck, you've gotten to 1. If you started with 2, you're also in luck because you divided by 2 and you got to 1. If you started with anything else, you probably have a few more steps to take. So this problem was introduced in 1937, and it's widely believed that this should end up giving us the number 1 eventually, but we don't know anything for sure about all numbers. So we have some progress on this conjecture. It does hold for all positive integers up to 2 to the 71st power. So as long as you picked some number below about 2.36 times 10 to the 21st, then you'll be good. You will eventually get back to 1. There's also a proof that came out in 2019 by Terence Tao, who's a very famous mathematician currently. I don't understand his claim or his proof, so I'm gonna, you know, kind of step aside for that. But it works for almost all integers in some way. He did some sort of a density analysis, sort of a probability type thing where, at least almost all integers, it will work. So if there are counterexamples, if there are numbers where they don't end up going back to 1, they're relatively rare in the group of all positive integers. So it's hard to find a counterexample, essentially, is what he said. But we're still looking. We still want to try to find this. And one of the reasons that we're just continuing to look and see if we can find a counterexample is because sometimes there are these like ridiculously large counterexamples. So I want to introduce you to the third sort of idea, sort of mathematical conundrum here, is Pouliot's conjecture. So hopefully at some point in your life you learned that every positive integer has a unique prime factorization. And so we're going to use that prime factorization of a positive integer to sort of analyze them. We'll say that an integer is of even type if there are an even number of primes in the factorization. So 6 would be of even type because it's 2 times 3 and there are 2 numbers there. And then it will be of odd type if there are an odd number of primes in the factorization. So since 8 is 2 times 2 times 2, there are 3 primes sitting there. That's an odd number, so 8 is of odd type. And we're going to sort of add a couple more things. E of n is going to be the number of positive integers up to and including n that have even type, and O of n will be similarly but for odd type. So for example, for the number 1, we're going to say that it has 0 primes in its prime factorization because it doesn't quite have a prime factorization because 1 itself isn't prime. So 1 has 0 primes in its prime factorization. 2 is a prime, so it just has that 1. 3 is prime, so it just has that 1. 4 has 2 primes. 5 is just the 1, 6 has 2 primes, and 7 is just the 1. So for numbers less than or equal to 7, we have 3 of even type, that 4, the 1, the 4, and the 6. And then we have 4 of odd type being 2, 3, 5, and 7. So notice we have more of odd type than of even type. And this is Pouliot's conjecture, is that for any n where we're starting at least at 2, we're going to have at least as many odd types as there are even types. There could be the same number, but if they're different, we have more odd than even. This works for a lot of numbers, but about 40 years after this was sort of conjectured, there was a counterexample found, approximately 906 million. And for this particular example, these numbers weren't computed directly. There was some other sort of analysis going on. But in this case, the number of odd type positive integers is one less than the number of even type. So it just barely does not meet this threshold of odd being greater than or equal to. You can get a little bit lower with your counterexample, but it's still in the 906 millions. And so it's a conjecture that works for a lot of numbers, but it doesn't work for all of them. And so even though this particular application or this particular result might not have an application, it might not be practical, but as mathematicians, we really like saying things that are true all the time. Or if it's not true all the time, we like to point out when it's not true. So one of the favorite hobbies of mathematicians is to poke holes in other people's proofs. So that's what mathematicians care about. Do we care about the physical world? Not really, is the honest answer. But if the physical world brings about a really interesting problem, then we will take that. And we will also, you know, allow the scientists to use our results, at least to some extent. I have a couple of qualifications there later. But one example of something that did not seem to have an application at all and then turned out to have one is this idea of imaginary numbers, right? So they were sort of introduced by mathematicians in 1572, and much later they turned out to be really helpful for modeling circuits and things in quantum mechanics. If you throw them into matrices, they're particularly helpful for quantum communication and things. I know that much because I was doing the math side, and we just remember the phrase of what it is that we're using them for, and we don't actually know much about the application itself. So if anyone knows how they actually work in this application, I'm fascinated to know. Another thing that happened is Lord Kelvin, so we were, you know, learning about some cold temperatures earlier in Kelvin. He brought about a theory of atoms called the vortex theory. And from what I can tell, essentially, Kelvin was thinking that different atoms and sort of these different elements were sort of made up of knots in space. So you could think about sort of a like vortex of air that's in sort of a circle. But then you could have sort of a twisted circle. So maybe it like, instead of just tying the circle together, you make a little loop in it and tie it up. And so that's what we would call a knot in mathematics. It always has to kind of loop back and connect back to itself. So when Kelvin brought this up, there was suddenly this like impetus to figure out all the different ways that you could make different knots. And one of the challenges with looking at different knots is just like with your shoelaces, you can sort of tangle them and untangle them. But as long as you can tangle and untangle without taking out your pair of scissors and chopping it up, then we say that it's the same knot. And it's really difficult to figure out if two knots are actually the same, if we can get there by tangling and untangling. So there was this effort to start to make a periodic table of elements by enumerating the different knots that there were. So it seemed, when I was doing some research, that fairly quickly people moved on from this theory in chemistry, but the mathematicians really enjoyed playing with knots, so we have continued playing with knots. And so we're very grateful for these sorts of strange theories that come up, and they might not actually be helpful in explaining what happens in the physical world, but they turn out to be really fun to think about. Another example, which is very applicable, is this SIR model, the susceptible, infectious, recovered. This is what you saw during COVID with the whole flatten the curve thing. And so this was sort of introduced in the early 20th century as a way to model disease spread through populations in biology. And so there is kind of a relationship between when a science sort of takes up one of these mathematical tools and says, oh, I can use this, and starts using it more, then mathematicians can be more motivated to look more in depth into these particular things. So there's more math work as well on these sorts of models. And then we also have an example of information theory. So this was introduced by Claude Shannon in the 1940s. This is really where my own research comes into play. But essentially, there's this idea of we're now communicating things using bits over a computer, and how much information can actually go through, and what happens if I lose one of the bits? How can I sort of restructure my message so that even if you lose one of the bits, you can figure out what it is that I meant to say originally? So that's another field of mathematics, which was really inspired by a development in technology, and now sort of has its own very theoretical research. So there is very much a back and forth between developments in technology, developments in other sciences, and then the mathematical theory there. So when scientists use math, overall, wonderful, please use it. It is there for you to use, but I do have a few little qualms. And so one of the things is that even though we might know that something's true as far as we actually care, mathematicians care more. We always care about trying to show that something's always true, right? We've calculated about 300 trillion digits of pi at this point. We're never going to use 300 trillion digits of pi, but we just wanted to see what the 300 trillionth digit of pi was. And I'm sure that people will continue computing that because that is one that just keeps giving. And so besides that, again, I mentioned really the why is important. Knowing that is important, certainly, but we really want to know why something is important. And for those of you who might be teaching or directing undergraduates, this is a big qualm of mine in teaching undergraduates. Sometimes the why relies on theorems that seem really uninteresting. So in calculus, we have a couple of theorems, like the intermediate value theorem and the mean value theorem. And the intermediate value theorem, to give you an idea, says something about if I go from point A to point B, at some point, I got in between them. And that's all it says. It's just that at some point, I hit that point in between. And when this is presented in calculus, it is very anticlimactic. But this theorem, even so it shows that something exists without showing how to find it. But this ends up being very important for showing that we can find the maximum and minimum values of a function, which turns out to be the thing that most engineers actually want. They want to figure out how to optimize things, how to find the maximum and minimum. So there's that foundation of why in things that feel very trivial, but they end up giving us really great results. The quadratic formula is another kind of big example there of, for those who might teach sort of high school level, or if you remember from your high school days, learning about quadratic equations, and completing the square is always the worst one. No one wants to complete the square. And then once you introduce the quadratic formula, it's like, yes, I have a formula that always gives me the right answer every single time. But the quadratic formula comes from completing the square. And so there is a bit of, it would be really great to learn how to complete the square and learn why the thing is true. The other difficulty with the quadratic formula is that if you get up to degree 3 in your polynomials, there is a cubic formula. You can look it up. It's a little bit scary to look at, so just beware. There also is a quartic formula. It is scarier to look at. It requires some scrolling, but it does exist. And it is provably impossible to make a quintic formula. So we're done at that point, and students are stuck with You just have to factor at that point. So the understanding the why behind the quadratic formula, I think, is very beautiful and important. I suppose if you're actually looking for a root, go ahead and use it. But understanding why it's there is really good. The last little qualm that I want to mention is to be careful about using the equal symbol. So if you want to use 3 as an approximation for pi or for e, you can, but use the squiggly ones instead of the straight ones, right? So you can say that pi is approximately e is approximately 3. When we talk about limits in calculus, we can use an equality. And so that gives some like very profound, maybe some kind of questionable mathematics for some of the philosophers. But we use approximation differently than we use equality. And that comes up a lot as well when we're using things like pi, right? If we take the cosine of pi, I think this one's pretty straightforward for the philosophers as well because it's trigonometry. That cosine's going to be -1. But then if you try to approximate the cosine, you get something that's very close to -1, but not actually equal to -1. So those are the little like qualms, and you know, make sure that you do this. But besides that, please do use mathematics. So thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.